I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be starting anew. Well, I wish I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be if out my heart I could fly. I'd soar to the sun and look down at the sea. Then I'd sing, 'cause I know, yeah. And I'd sing, singing, 'cause I know how it feels. I know how it feels to be free. Yeah, yeah, I know how it feels. Yes, I know how it feels. How it feels to be free. Oh, Lord.
Good morning. You are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM in Hudson, New York, and this is the Prison Voices Project. I'm your host this morning, Karanja K. Takaro. Today is Thursday, January 28, 2016. This morning's show will cover highlights and takeaways from our 2015 shows, including clips from Beth Ritchie's presentation at SUNY New Paltz on the problems of carceral feminism, my interview with Salvatore Ingo De Miro on food, environmental justice, and the prison industrial complex, and Alexandra Cox's interview with Bobby Lane of Exodus Transitional Community, a reentry program in Newburgh, New York. In addition, we will have musical selections from Sam Henshaw, Pharoah Sanders, and Eva J. Let us begin with Pharoah Sanders' 1980 release off of his Journey to the One album entitled Freedom.
Thank you.
listening to WGXC 90.7 FM in Hudson, New York, and this is the Prison Voices Project. Our first highlight comes from our March 12th show with Dr. Beth Ritchie and her presentation on the problems of carceral feminism.
Thank you for coming, and I'm thrilled to be spending a little bit of time with you this afternoon talking about the problem with carceral feminism. That's the title of the talk, The Problem with Carceral Feminism, Race, Gender, and Mass Criminalization. When I was thinking about that title, I realized that I could have called this talk something more like How Black Feminist Anti-Violence Activism Taught Me to Be a Prison Abolitionist. Would you have come to that one too? Am I saying it? How Black Feminist Anti-Violence Activism Taught Me to Be a Prison Abolitionist. Now, both titles suggest that really what I'm trying to do in the little bit of time that we have is talk a little bit about some larger conceptual and political issues, but also I'm going to talk story and use some examples from both my own experience and the experiences of people that I know for only about 40 minutes or so. I keep my eye on the clock to really think about how sexuality and class and gender and racial identity become sources of vulnerability for Black women as we experience a particularly pernicious form of violence, sexual violence and domestic violence, and how that vulnerability, instead of being protected by the state, how that vulnerability is actually targeted by America's prison nation through a process of criminalization that's made worse by carceral feminism. And then I'm going to talk about what we need to do about that, all those things, as organizers, as engaged academics, as political workers, human rights activists, students, what we need to do about that to change the world. So the big frames here are gender violence, sexual assault, battering, human trafficking. That's big frame number one. Big frame number two is carceral feminism. Big frame number three is criminalization. Number four is the prison nation. And number five is prison abolition. As Monique said, I'm trained as a sociologist, trained in qualitative research methods. And I find myself right now directing an interdisciplinary research center on race and public policy. Most of my academic work and my political work has been in jails and, to a lesser extent, state prisons. I did a lot of work not far from here, Bedford Hills, Rikers Island, Taconic. And I spend a lot of time in communities where incarcerated populations come from. Right now, I'm teaching at a maximum security prison for men, Stateville, and facilitating a support group for trans women at the Cook County Jail. My work focuses both on the macro, or the large structural issues, as well as the micro, or individual level issues that people experience. And I try to bring the large structural issues and the micro issues together to talk about how people find themselves entrapped in the criminal legal system. Most of my focus is on women and girls, but that means also focusing on the people who we're in community with. And if you were sort of to do a list of the topics that I study and write on, you'd include policing, surveillance, state policy, all really to try to talk about inequality and how inequality is really quite literally captured, inequality is captured into correctional facilities in this country. So in that brief bio, I want to make sure that you know that I am coming to this work both as an activist and as an academic. And really it's been 30 years or more when I began my activism work in New York City, and have since gone on to work both in Chicago as well as a number of national organizations, Insight, Critical Resistance, National Network for Women in Prison, et cetera. It's been about 30 years since I really began my work as a Black feminist scholar and anti-violence activist. As I said, I was working primarily in New York City, in Harlem. Some of you know where Harlem is, I imagine. Working in Harlem with a group of women of color, where we organized one of the first anti-violence programs in the country, specifically for women of color who were experiencing gender violence. Now, most of you know that Harlem is a community where the activism around race and racial justice was critically important. It's, of course, a community where there's a lot of cultural activism, political activism. It was a place 30 years ago that made us feel, as women of color organizing in that community, that this was a place that was ripe for the kind of activism, feminist activism that we were interested in. We wanted to bring questions of gender inequality to discussions of racial justice. And we thought that the community was ready for us. I don't know how many of you have ever been in that position where you're having a discussion with people who you think are going to agree with you. Yeah, and then you find out. We were surprised, perhaps it was naive, we were surprised to find ourselves engaged in struggle with men and with male-identified community leadership, all of whom were people of color, Black and Latino at the time, this was 30 years ago, who were resisting our attempt to take up gender inequality as part of a racial justice agenda. That same year, I attended one of the first conferences of the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. If you don't know about them, you should. The National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, it was in Milwaukee. And I bumped into a group of dynamic feminists who were critically building a grassroots movement in this country. This was 30 years ago. Building a grassroots movement in this country to respond to the problem of violence against women. Rape crisis centers, which were not populating most places, certainly not on college campuses. We were opening rape crisis centers, opening hotlines, opening shelters for battered women. And it was because of the analysis of gender inequality that we felt like we had to take up the questions of gender violence. So we understood then that what appeared as individual problems, as micro-level experiences, were very common, and they had a structural component to it. That is, rape and battering and harassment and trafficking was linked to the larger structural systems of inequality around gender. So that resonated quite deeply with the work that we were trying to do in Harlem, but the problem was that at that conference, most of the women were white. Okay? So there was a gathering at that conference of women of color who said, so all of the people talking about racial justice seem to be talking only as if all people are men. All of the people talking about gender violence are talking as if all people, or all women in that instance, are white. And where were we? We began a national effort by women of color all around the country for the last 30 years to make sure that the growing movement to end gender violence paid attention to race and class and sexuality, just as the growing movement around racial justice paid attention to women. It was for me a very exciting time, a moment where there was lots of tension, lots of conflict, lots of confrontation, but also one where we felt like we could use our energetic commitment to principles of justice that transcended the a gender and race divide, if you will, to make sure that the work, the analysis, but really more importantly, the work, could incorporate attention to race, class, gender, and sexuality. And that work would be embedded in a sense of everyday activism. Some of you who are students of African American studies should start to hear something that sounds like critical race theory. If you're a student in gender and women's studies programs, this should sound like feminist theory or intersectional analyses of women's studies. It should sound like Black feminism. What we did was build from our experience listening to women who were raped, stalked, kidnapped, harassed, humiliated, degraded by individuals as well as the state. We'll talk a little bit more about that. We listened to the stories, and we tried to build coalition with those people who were doing work kind of on the periphery of the stories that we were listening to, because we were listening to the stories of women of color. We thought that the social conditions were ripe for a radical analysis of race, class, gender, and violence. And unfortunately, what we found at that time, which, and here's the secret, what we still find now, people who work on questions of racial justice don't always take into account gender, and people who work on issues of violence often talk about women, and sometimes they talk about a diverse group of women, but they don't critically understand how structural racism impacts the experiences that Black and other women of color feel. So we had been doing this work for 30 years. In some ways, it's the work of my academic and political work that I'm the most proud of, but it's actually the work that I feel like we've been least successful in creating change about. That is to say, I still think the dynamic that I was experiencing 30 years ago still defines racial justice organizing and defines work to end violence against women today. During those 30 years of trying to do that work, there was a new dilemma, a new set of challenges that got sort of overlaid on top of trying to do racial justice work with intentionality around gender inequality, or trying to do anti-violence work that intentionally interrogates structural racism. And that new overlay is what I call the buildup of a prison nation. A prison nation is a place where we start to pay attention to both ideological and public policy shifts that have changed the very way that we engage with each other, especially the way that we respond to marginal groups in society. A prison nation is a place where we divest resources, health resources, mental health resources, educational resources. We divest resources from people who have the highest need, and instead we blame them for what's wrong. Some people call that neoliberalism. We divest resources from the communities with the most need, and we blame people for what's wrong. The blaming of people means that we not just treat them differently for what has happened to them, but we also turn their problems into crimes. Right? So we not only say they have problems that they've caused themselves, but they're at fault for those problems, and those problems become crimes. We respond to the problems, which we've then turned into crimes, through law enforcement, aggressive law enforcement strategy. We see this around questions of gender policing, which I'll talk about in a moment. And in so doing, the laws and the law enforcement strategies that we develop for the crimes that used to be social problems that we blame people for in a prison nation puts us in a position where we are, I think, violating civil and human rights of marginalized groups on a regular basis. So I'm using the notion of a prison nation to talk about a set of conditions that are externally imposed on communities, and those conditions limit people's opportunity to take care of themselves and the people that they live with, and instead we impose a set of state sanctions or controls over them, new laws, new codes of behavior, again, aggressive law enforcement, and we develop an ideology that blames people for what's wrong with them and considers them undeserving, expendable, at risk, and risky at the same time. And in some ways, we take away their rights in order to protect the public good of other people, people who have power, status, and wealth. We do that to immigrants, we do it to young people, we do it to trans people, we do it to Black people, etc. So a prison nation is a place where we do those things, and those are kind of public policy or ideological things, but it's also, a prison nation is also a place where we put 7 million people under the surveillance of the criminal legal system. A prison nation in the United States is a place where we house 25% of the world's prisoners. It's a place where we have the highest incarceration rate, not because we have the highest crime rate, but because we have chosen to respond to human suffering and social problems with criminalization. In this country, we house more people in harsher conditions for longer periods of time, further and further from their communities, for less serious offenses than almost any other country in the world, and especially when we compare ourselves to our civilized peers, if you will. Now, some of you may be following this pattern of mass incarceration and criminalization and would say to me, but Beth, incarceration rates are going down, especially for people like black women. And there are some reports that are making that claim. And one way to look at that, we would say that's really good news. I thought it was good news when I started reading it, but we have to think about a prison nation as something more than the number of people we put behind bars and in cages. A prison nation is a place where we have more people under state control than we ever did. It's where we have schools, like we do in Chicago, where there are actual holding pens. They look like prison cells. Holding pens in public schools for children who break rules. And that's a city where we just closed 50 public schools. A prison nation is a place where you're arrested if you're pregnant if you use drugs, even though we have cut out drug treatment programs in your community and have decreased our funding for reproductive health services. That's a prison nation. A prison nation is a place where, as some of you may have seen in the New York Times, a very compelling story, where we have no place for trans people in jails. So we put them in a very vulnerable place in general populations, denying protection for sexual assault, denying hormone treatment, which is a health issue, right? Prison nation is where we have people who are required by the state to wear an ankle bracelet, having to pay for that ankle bracelet themselves, where we see a privatization of parole services, where we see an increase in things like loitering services and the enforcement of loitering services, and we have Safe Communities Act, on and on. That's what a prison nation is, and it's much more than just the number of people who are incarcerated in private jails and prisons, in detention centers, in secured treatment programs, etc. So the crisis that we face in a prison nation is one that's an economic crisis. That's why we're having trouble paying for almost anything else. In the state that I live in Illinois, facing up to 30% budget cuts for social services, guess where they're hiring? Correctional officers. It's an economic crisis. It's also a political crisis. It's a moral crisis, I would argue. Important for us today, it's also a feminist crisis. Prison nation is a feminist crisis because of the problem of carceral feminism. Here's how. Much of the work to end violence against women in the last 30 years has benefited from the ideological shifts of a prison nation. There's harsher punishments for so-called violent perpetrators. There's rape shield laws. There's mandatory arrest in cases of battering. We have all kinds of technological advances that will help us monitor where potential perpetrators are. We have sex offender registries. We have a way to assess, do screening to see who might use violence toward women. There's a fundamental conservative public commitment to law and order that means that violence against women is sort of considered part of what we have to pay attention to in order to keep people safe. The problem with carceral feminism, and I'll explain a little bit more what that is in a moment, is that although there's very good evidence that the 30 years that we've been doing anti-violence activism around gender violence, there's good evidence that some women are safer today than they were 30 years ago because of the buildup of a prison nation. It's also the case that there are some women who are in more danger than ever because of the buildup of a prison nation, combined with the gender violence that they continue to experience. In fact, I argue that the strategic decisions, the directions that the anti-violence movement has taken over time, has protected some women and left other women in harm's way, directly in harm's way, by the buildup of a prison nation.
And that was Eva J. with Think of You. You are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM in Hudson, New York, and this is the Prison Voices Project. Continuing with our highlights and takeaways from 2015, now here's an excerpt from my interview with Salvatore Ingle Damaro. Begin by asking Professor Ingle Damaro to discuss broadly his understanding of the relationship between prison farming, prison gardening, and the prison industrial complex.
From what I know so far, I mean, there are many aspects that one can include about these connections, but there are obviously, maybe not so obviously, the connections between plantation systems and incarceration. And that is gone. It's something that is continuous to this day, in which you had slave laborers who then become imprisoned laborers later on in the 20th century. And that still goes on to this day. Like in Louisiana, for example, you've got these plantations of cotton. But there are also other issues as well, like the health of the people inside, and what kind of food they get, what kind of access to what kind of environment. And that's something that, in terms of the history of food justice, environmental justice in particular, it seems to be very rare that people are making these connections still.
Mm.
And so that's something that I'd like to work on. I know some others, very few are working on, but broadly speaking, one can think about the building of the prison industrial complex as having an environmental impact. Some people have been looking at that, and California is one of those examples. I think Craig Gilmore has written an article in 2006 about this, and in which some people, like in Oakland area, I think, were making the connection between environmental degradation and the building of a prison complex. Now that can go both ways, because sometimes, like for example, there's a, of the many facilities in Hudson Valley, there are also a few that which have, you know, natural preserves that are being made out of these prisons as well. You know, and they become like natural habitat, you know, for some. From some species, and it's crazy. So mm-hmm. It's like with, you know, with war zones as well. It's kind of similar. You've got these like one of the most well kept nature preserves is the boundary between South and North Korea. You know, it's just there because you know, it's just lack of access.
Right.
You know, allows a lot of people, a lot of species to, I guess, thrive. But in any case, that's not the kind of. So we have to look at many different sides of this issue is from both a historical perspective in terms of the overall impact of prisons on people and, as well as environment, and also how prisons themselves can be used as an excuse to say, oh look, we can, you know, build natural preserves and like have nice scenic farmland, you know, around prisons, and isn't that nice? And in the meantime, you know, people are getting screwed over. But in terms of food justice and environmental justice in particular, I think like Martin Luther King was making some sort of connections already in 67, you know, before he got murdered, in terms of the health of workers and the environment which they were working in.
Mm-hmm.
Now that was not extended to the prisons, but I think it's just a short step away. If you've got you know, a lot of people that are getting inside, you know, there, and this is something that I've been wanting to work on and alert people to, is that they're being put in a hazardous place, just like when you have poor working conditions or prison conditions are environmental hazards. So who gets placed in these kinds of environmental hazards should be looked at as an environmental justice issue, which is something that carries over from what Martin Luther King was already talking about with respect to the workplace.
Okay.
With respect to food justice, I already touched upon that as well, but this can be connected in terms of land access, and historically, African American farmers. You know, as was mentioned by one article they alerted me to, which is a wonderful one about Soul Fire Farm that we'll talk about a bit later on.
Mm-hmm.
But the connection between the civil rights movement and African American farmers, you know, is really tight, and tighter than I ever imagined myself. So mm-hmm. I got educated on it, and but you know that. The land issue is particularly important because by having a history of forced landlessness, if you like, mm-hmm. And lack of adequate access to food, that's one way in which people are put into situations of dependency, and context that then can promote people being in desperate situation enough so that it creates the conditions for incarceration as well. And so that's another thing that one can think about in terms of the history of who makes food, who has access to what food, as intimately related to land issues, and then people being forced off the land and forced into conditions in which they can't even feed themselves, and economically dependent on a system that is white establishment, that creates also the context in which people, most people of color, overwhelmingly get incarcerated. I mean, that's one of those connections that one can try to draw out historically between all these different.
Some more local issues. I then asked questions surrounding prison farming and prison agriculture within the Hudson Valley.
From my limited experiences, stronger maximum security and Woodbourne medium security, at least I've noticed that there is quite an awareness, an acute awareness on the part of the people inside, that of the importance of both having adequate food to eat and also the importance of growing their own food. Now, historically, in New York State, from what I've learned, is that most of the, throughout the United States, as far as I'm aware, most of the burgeoning prison industrial complex came out during the 1980s and expanded rapidly into rural areas as never before, because it used to be more in the rural and in the urban and peri-urban, or like around the cities. And so one of the things that happened early on, it seemed, besides the plantation turning to prisons, which is still practiced in some places in this country, but there was some farmland around places like Woodbourne Prison, which I think used to be a boarding school, and people inside used to be able to farm outside. This huge amount of farmland surrounding the prison complex that was taken away when New York State was having a budget problem. As usual, they take it out on the people inside. One of the first people to lose out, education, land, you name it, and health. And so this was part of that entire scheme of slashing budgets. It was also to privatize, to sell a lot of land around prisons. So what happened in Woodbourne, for example, is that eventually the people inside, were clamoring and got, after a lot of struggle, from what I heard from them, they got a courtyard within the prison turned into a garden. And I'll have to talk about what the difference is between farming and gardening in a moment. But it basically a courtyard there was a whole bunch of debris and asphalt or actually cement was just covered over by some imported soil. In fact, I was teaching soil science to people there, and we got to dig, and I got to see actually what it looks like. It's very thin soil. It's not exactly the best, but still, it was marvelous what they could grow. And that was one way in which, actually, it's a two-edged sword. I mean, one way in which they could get fresh vegetables that otherwise you wouldn't get, and they're so expensive anyway. And you know better than I, what it's like to get proper food. But also the double-edged part of that is that there's a long queue to get into the garden, the guards can use that as blackmail,
mm-hmm.
and that can also work some tensions that really need not be there, because if you had all that huge farmland outdoors, in which people inside could go outside,
right.
and farm like they used to. Then they could also dispense with a whole bunch of very expensive, crappy food, if you pardon the expression.
Mm-hmm.
The least nutritious, most unhealthy food coming from the same corporation that brings us the same sort of sordid food at
mm-hmm.
the universities, like where we're at, Sodexo. all that could be cut out, and people could actually feed themselves, and actually even have a surplus to sell, so that it could also save some money. Now, at maximum security in Shangnam, the situation is really dire. And I know that the people inside, you know, I've spoken to them about this, and asked them, you know, what steps they're trying to take to get some sort of garden put into place. There's loads of space even within the compound in which they could do it, and it's already covered in soil. You don't even have to make any effort to build up soil in within that maximum security complex. So there's no reason why they shouldn't be there. And so they told me that, you know, they've been petitioning for years, but they're very stubborn in the administration. And I'm not sure, you know, what the best steps would be to help them out with this. And one of the things that I was hoping to do is compare, you know, notes with Woodbourne and see how they sorted that out. But I've not been invited back to Woodbourne, so that's not going to happen anytime soon.
Did I read me? This place is my home. Built here to protect me. So tell me why I'm running back to your authority. You move my mind from the weakest part of me. I don't need nothing more. Time of day with the freedom to fall and fall astray. Nah, I don't wanna be a slave.
GXC 90.7 FM in Hudson, New York. This is the Prison Voices Project. That was Sam Henshaw with Autonomy. Our last excerpt comes from Alexandra Cox's interview with Bobby Lane from Exodus Transitional Community in Newburgh, New York.
Well, Exodus basically provides supportive services for formerly incarcerated men and women. We assist them in resume and employment development, internet training. We assist them in disclosure statements in the sense of, you know, showing them how to express themselves while in the presence of employees when it comes up to regarding the criminal offense, you know, how to share that experience and how not to let that experience overwhelm them to some degree. But more importantly, show how that experience made them a better person as a result of, you know, rethinking situations, rethinking certain circumstances. But more importantly, changing their way of thinking so they can change their way of seeing, so they can change their way of doing things, so they can just change their way of life in every sense of the word. Entering Newburgh is like coming from one wilderness experience mm-hmm. to another. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by wilderness experience, you know, when we look at the book of Exodus, where we get the name Exodus from, in the book of Exodus, it spoke about a particular people who were in a particular bondage. And these particular people was being freed from bondage en route to their promised land. But in between their bondage and the promised land was a wilderness experience. And that wilderness experience was the struggles that they had to go through, the challenges, the things that they had to confront from day to day. And so it is the same with a person, you know, coming out of prison, because coming out of prison is like coming out of bondage. And for some of us, our promised land would be to return to our relationships, return to our families, return to our communities, receive a job, or obtain and maintain a job, so that when we get out, we find out that's not our promised land, you know, and we find ourselves in the wilderness, we find ourselves in the struggle. So Exodus is here to assist those men and women that's coming out, you know, to deal with the struggles, to deal with that wilderness experience, to give them some insight, to give them some foresight, to show them how that they're not by themselves, that more importantly, there's someone here, you know, to give them a hand up as opposed to a handout. What we have found, one of the most important things we found to be the foundation to successful reentry is employment. And it's also one of the successful keys to minimize the recidivism rate as much as possible, you know. Another barrier we find is transportation. That's one of the major barriers up here in the city of Newburgh is transportation. Most people who do have their license, the license has been suspended by virtue of DWI, by virtue of child support. Then you may have another barrier such as, you know, child care, you know, where women have children, you know, but it comes, has the problem when it comes to, you know, placing their child in child care or someone babysitting them or minding the kids and things of that sort, you know.
I wondered sort of what interests you about the, doing this kind of work and why you enjoy doing this work and what brings you to it.
Okay, I myself is a former incarcerated person. Approximately 20 years of my life was spent in prison. And as a result of, you know, coming out and seeing the kind of work that needed to be done. In fact, I just used my own personal experience, you know, coming out, seeing how complicated it was, you know, to achieve employment, to see how complicated it was to, you know, find housing. Even though I was connected with family members, but nevertheless, I wanted to be, you know, my own, you know, person. I wanted to be self-sufficient. I wanted to be able to stand on my own 2 feet. And so, you know, when I came home, I got a job as a counselor working in alcohol and substance abuse field for some years. And then the opportunity came for me to take on this position because this site became available last year. And Julio Medina, the executive director, as well as the founder of Exodus, is a personal friend of mine. And I've been knowing him since 1991, 92. You know, so when this opportunity came, so I just took advantage of that, would like to come on board and manage this site here in Newburgh. You know, what we found is that it's through our experiences that we can share with other people who is going through the same experience that we're going through. And what we're finding is that sometimes it's best received from a person who have experienced what you have experienced. You know, one of the things I appreciate about going inside to the prisons is that, you know, they can see a person who's been through the experience and who's out now and is you know, just making a change, just creating a change, you know, showing them that, you know, it is possible. Because most of the time, you know, you hear stories about people that they come out, they go back in.
Right.
You know, they come out and they go back in. Whereas you see a person like me who's been home for approximately going on 7 years now, or rather it is 7 years, going into my 8th year. And they see that, you know, I'm determined to show them that, you know, life is about the changes and it's about the choices that we make.
Mm-hmm.
And I share with them that, you know, in spite of our situation, you know, in spite of our circumstance, you know, we have the ability, mm-hmm. you know, to rise above it.
You know, I guess one of the things that is a question that always comes up in this work is like, you know, you have both like the barriers to doing well. This isn't even about reoffending, but just doing well in general. Like you come out, it's hard to find housing, it's hard to find a job.
Right.
But then there's also the personal transformation after having been inside.
Right.
What were some of the strategies that you used to both tackle those like real life barriers,
right.
but then the personal barriers?
Well, you know, when I look at my situation, I look at my circumstance, it was somewhat different than the average person that's in today. You know, when I went in, I had connections, you know, I had family contact. When I came out, you know, I still had connections, I still had family contact. I had developed good friendships. I had developed good relationships. You know, I came out with a sense of hunger, you know, to reinvent myself, you know, give myself a makeover. And I was determined to do that. And, my main objective or concern was to not let any person, place, or thing get in my way towards achieving that particular goal. Like today, I continue doing what I'm doing, and I have to do something. I have to be active.
Mm-hmm.
I have to be proactive. You know, when I leave work, you know, I'm headed to the gym. And after the gym, you know, I may go home. I may get a call and ask me, do I like to come by and do a speaking engagement? So I'll come by and do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, I do this work, you know, Monday through Friday.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a recovery coach every other weekend. Oh, you know, for those that's listening, that's behind the wall, as we say. You know, it's about thinking positive. It's about, you know, speaking positive. It's about leading a life that's positive. But more importantly, you know, it's about changing your way of thinking. You know, if you're in your cell, if you're in the dorm setting, if you're in the cube, there's three questions that I share with you that you ask yourself. And those three questions are, you know, who am I? Who am I? Give you a sense of identity. Where do I come from? Where do I come from? Give you a sense of heritage. What can I do? What can I do implies, what's my potential?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who am I? Where do I come from? What can I do? And you say to yourself that, you know, as long as you're living, you have a pulse.
How do you learn about where you come from when you don't get access to resources to learn about where you come from?
Oh, good question. Where do we come from? It's asking yourself these questions, or sharing the same question with a person that you may walk and talk with, you know, throughout that yard experience, throughout that gym experience, throughout that TV room experience, you know, where you find yourself, you know, having conversations. You know, sometimes we're so quick to paint negative pictures of ourselves. For example, I'm a stick-up kid.
Mm.
You know, I'm a hustler. You know, I'm a drug seller. No, that's not who you are. That's what you did. And we need to be able to have the ability to be able to differentiate or distinguish between one and the other. You know, because sometimes, you know, as we go through life, we find ourselves defining ourselves by the things that we do.
Or being defined by the very worst thing we've done, which,
exactly.
If we think about all of us,
exactly.
would never want to be defined in
exactly.
that way.
You know, and as much as we muster up the energy and the effort, you know, to define ourselves by the worst things, you know, we can take that same energy and that same effort
mm-hmm.
and muster up the best things in us and define ourselves according to that category.
Right. Yeah, that makes it seems so important.
You know, one of the videos that we show called Hard Road Home is basically about, you know, people, you know, coming out of prison and going through the Exodus experience.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the thoughts during the documentary that Julio shares is that we're not defined by that worst moment.
Mm-hmm.
We only define by that worst moment if we allow ourselves to be defined,
right.
You know, by that worst moment. And what I found is that, you know, how you define yourself determines how far you go in life. It also determines the things that you engage.
You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM. The Prison Voices Project airs on the third Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. If you're listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please mail us at 704 Hudson Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback, please email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
Chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be starting anew. Well, I wish I could be like